Welcome to the Haemin Lee Mysteries Resolved podcast, episode 7. My name is Debbie Simons, and this week I'm going to be looking at the actions of Haemin Lee's family from the time of her disappearance and murder in January of 1999 up until this past spring in March of 2025. Parts of it, of course, will be much more detailed than others. But this is an area of characters in the case that I don't think has been explored very well. Hay has been talked about a lot, and what she was really like, and her friends, of course, have been endlessly interviewed about her. But her family has not been examined much in detail. And they played a very important role in how certain aspects of this case came out. I do want to make it clear that I have the greatest respect for these people. I'm not trying to be exploitative or anything like that in examining their motives, supposed motives, and also their actions. But they did have an impact on the outcome of this case. That is indisputable. They even had an impact on what happened in the March 2025 hearing in which the final disposition was made about Adnan's case. Yes, he would continue to be a convicted murderer on the books, but no, he would not be going back to prison because his sentence was commuted to time served. The way that was decided is almost entirely due to the Lee family, to their lawyer, and to the political pressure that they were able to bring to bear. Again, no criticism is implied. And by the way, that hearing was the one time when the Lees kind of overstepped their bounds, because the purpose of these hearings in which a murder case is being re-examined in the sense of the decision being made of whether or not the conviction will be vacated, the victim's family does have the right to speak, but they're supposed to confine themselves solely to testimony about the victim and also the impact on their family of the loss of their family member. The Lee family went way beyond that. And they went around in the weeks before that hearing saying that they were going to present evidence, that they had new evidence, none of which was presented at the hearing. And that is not the purpose. They are not giving evidence at trial. They are simply speaking for the victim at this hearing. But I lay the blame for that overstepping clearly at the feet of the judge who allowed them to do this. And also, I think somewhat it's pretty clear that their lawyer has really been pushing them to keep trying to re-adjudicate this case. So on the whole, the Lee family has acted entirely within the law, and they have acted honorably. And by that I mean not, of course, that I agree with them that Adnan Syed killed Hay. That's just ridiculous if you look at the evidence. But here's what you need to realize. They've never looked at the evidence. They have two main sources of information that they have depended upon all these years. One is Hay's diary, and one is the trial itself. Hay's diary is 99% Adnan adulatory, if I may use that term. Oh, my baby, he's so sweet. I love him so much. But as I mentioned before, there are scattered references here and there to perfectly normal teenage relationship angst and jealousy. But when you have nothing else to hang on to, that little tiny plank in the middle of the ocean looks pretty big. And of course, the other piece of evidence, which is so obvious it almost doesn't need to be mentioned, is the trial, which, guess what, resulted in Adnan's conviction. So, of course, they hang on to that. Well, the jury found him guilty. Why are people now saying he's not guilty? He certainly is. So, with that in mind, always remembering the Lees are in the part of Hay's life that she has kept totally separate from her so-called real life. She would have said, my real life is at school. My real life is with my friends and the parties and the dates and the dances, that kind of thing. That's where I thrive. My real life is in the classroom. My real life is in the dreams that I have of going on to college. And more, at the very end of her life, she would have said, my real life is with Don Kleindienst. Full-time girlfriend is one of the descriptive terms she used of herself in that rather pathetic AOL profile that she posted not long before her death. But the Lees here, I want to make the point, they are not passive. They are active. And the actions that they took have consequences. So there are two main actions that they took that had just rippling effects. The first one, I'm going to put them in this order because they occurred roughly in this order in actual time. The first thing they did was that they hired a consulting firm, a private consulting firm called the Anihi Group, headed up by a woman named Mandy Johnson, to look into Hay's disappearance. Now, I go into a bit of a rabbit hole in my book in the appendix explaining what the word Anihi means. So if you're curious about that, I would encourage you to get the book. I think it is fair to say that Mandy Johnson had a very strong anti-Muslim bias. And this comes out very clearly in the materials that she produced, both for the Lee family and for the Baltimore Police Department. So let's think about this. I talked in a previous episode about what Don said when Mandy Johnson interviewed him. And I made the point then that it is clear that Johnson interviewed Don in person, but that she gleaned the information that she had about Adnan solely from Hay's diary. So that ended up with a rather lopsided report. And what she says about Don is really quite favorable. He seems mature. He seems emotionally well-balanced. He doesn't seem particularly panicky about Hay's disappearance. Boy, that should have been a red flag. And so why did the Lees do this? Well, it's easy, again, if you're sort of looking for conspiracies, to say, oh, well, this seems rather weird. The family of the victim is trying to nudge the police in a certain direction. Well, yes, of course, that's exactly what they're doing, because they believe that Adnan is the one who's done something to Hay. This makes perfect sense. But how do they light upon this Mandy Johnson person? Well, if you go back and you look at the notes on a now defunct website called the AdnanSayedWiki.com, which my husband and I tried to rescue when it kind of disappeared from the internet, you will find out that a man named Chris Yee, so that's Y-I, is the only actual employee of the Anihi Group. Mandy Johnson is the owner and the operator, and then her one person working underneath her is this Chris Yee. Now, I will point out that Y-I is the same last name as L-E-E, so it's simply a way of anglicizing the Korean version of this last name. Korea, by the way, has about 5 surnames. They have very few. So Lee and Park and Kim are the 3 I know about. There are 2 others. I don't know what they are. But so this last name is very, very common. And so it says in the description of the Anihi group that Chris Yee acted as a liaison and a translator for the Lee family. Well, now that's very interesting, isn't it? So now the reason why Tae-Soo Kim, Hae's uncle, ends up hiring Mandy Johnson is pretty easily explained, or at least imagined, that Chris Lee, I'm going to call him because that's much easier to pronounce, was a member of the Korean community, very possibly a member of the same church as Hae's family. And you can imagine him going up to Tae-Soo Kim and saying, you know, I understand that they've never found your niece. And it's been, well, we could say a couple of weeks. We know this report was produced sometime toward the end of January. It very clearly says on the cover page that it was commissioned by Tae-Soo Kim. And so Chris says, if I may call him that, listen, I work for a private consulting company. We do investigations. We run private security. How about if we do a little checking up on the main people you think might be implicated in your niece's disappearance? And that's how this report could have come about very, very easily. Maybe he even said, we'll give you a special price because you and I go to the same church. Who knows? Whatever. So I talked about that report earlier when I was talking about Don's evolving stories, and that it's to Mandy Johnson that he propounds this absolutely absurd idea, this preposterous idea that Hae had gone to California. Maybe she'd even flown to California and left her car at the airport parking lot, her almost brand new car. No way. But Mandy Johnson is willing to listen to Don. It's kind of interesting because, of course, if Hae has gone to California, then Hae cannot also be dead in Baltimore. But of course, when she does that report, I'm going to say it's probably a good 10 days to 2 weeks before Hae's body is going to be discovered. So she seems quite willing to entertain this ridiculous theory of Don's. Whereas with Adnan, she does a lot of damning with faint praise. I'm not going to go into it a lot here, but the picture that she paints of the two young men, they are absolutely different. Adnan comes across as kind of a creep, and Don comes across as this mature, thoughtful young man. So there it is. But the reason why this is important, this action of the Lees, is not that report in and of itself so much at all. It's that then Johnson is on the police radar. I'm going to read to you something that I copied down from the company website. Clients use the Anihi group in their search for missing persons, compiling psychological and or behavioral profiles, patent and copyright research, or pre-legal preparation before they take on the big guys. That part is in quotations. We are not a private investigative agency and subsequently do not handle divorce or domestic cases. Now, here's the important part. For the record, we often accept cases from law enforcement agencies on a pro bono basis. So I am going to speculate. This has never actually been directly said, but I think it must have been done, that the Lees passed on this report, this initial missing persons report, to Joseph O'Shea, to the Baltimore County Police Department. As I said before, it's not really a missing persons report because it's not about the person who is missing. It's about the two possible people who had a hand in making her missing. So then time goes on, Hae's body is discovered, and the case is transferred over to Baltimore City. Well, that missing persons report from Mandy Johnson would have been in the police files that O'Shea transferred over to Detectives Ritz Emma Gillivary. And so then she's now on Baltimore City's radar. Here's somebody who has specifically said she's willing to work pro bono with law enforcement. Then in August of 99, the decision was made to ask Mandy Johnson to produce some more information. Now Adnan, of course, has been arrested and he is in jail and he is awaiting trial. Remember, he's denied bail, a horrible injustice that really affected the way his case preparation went forward. If he had been out of jail and been able to meet with Christina Gutierrez more in person, I think the trial might have gone very differently. But anyway, he's in jail and Baltimore City decides, let's get this woman to add to our case files. In particular, they seem to have wanted her to produce a motive that they could pass on to the prosecution. So I'm going to read you one of the most damning sections of this. And I will point out, Rabia Chaudhry memorably labels this whole report hot garbage. You could use some stronger words if you were so inclined. The title of this is A Report on Islamic Thought and Culture with Emphasis on Pakistan, a comparative study relevant to the upcoming trial of Adnan Syed. And this time, by the way, the document is very clearly directed at Ritz and McGillivary. That's William Ritz and Gregory McGillivary. I don't think I've given their first names in these episodes. And this really gives them kind of a crowbar to use to force this whole idea of Muslim honor killing into this case. So, as I say in my book, what Johnson clearly did in this report was to take the most extreme, egregious example she could find of male-dominant culture in Islamic countries and apply them to an American teenager. Does any of this directly apply to Adnan? No, of course not. And one of the most outrageous things in this report, and I'm not really quite sure where she even found out about this, but Adnan had bought Hay a scarf as a gift when he had gone during the summer of 98 to Texas to an Islamic kind of convention or conference with his dad. Hay mentions in her diary that Adnan had called her several times and made a special effort and used a phone card and all that kind of thing. Of course, this is well before Adnan has his cell phone. She does not mention the scarf. I don't know where Mandy Johnson got the idea of the scarf, but here's how she interprets this very innocent gift. After giving her a veil, boy, it must have been a pretty big scarf, literally covering her so that only he could have her, he set her apart from all others and for him alone. Baloney. Then, she says, I'm skipping around in this, it's quite long. It is acceptable for a Muslim man to control the actions of a woman by completely eliminating her, and still remains possible under this system to find peace and forgiveness with God at the same time. Within this harsh culture, he has not violated any code. He has defended his honor. And then she says, under Islamic law, her murder was sanctioned, to which I say, baloney. So this was produced while Detectives Ritz and McGillivary are still putting together the case, and then it's passed on to Kevin Urich, who is the lead prosecutor at trial. It's often been described as a fluffer for the prosecution's case. Now, I had had the impression that this report was used directly in trial as part of the evidence. That is apparently not quite true, that it was not quoted from directly. Certainly the ideas in it were used, especially this idea of honor killing. But Rabia Chaudhry has a memorable scene in her book, I believe it is, yes, where she's looking through the things that she wants to give Sarah Koenig, and Sarah Koenig shows her this report, and Rabia describes being shocked to her very core. She says, "What is this? I have never seen this before." And that's when she reads all this ridiculous nonsense about the veil for the first time. So this report, while it does not directly impinge on any kind of evidence in the trial, is used as a way in, as a possible motive. So I said last time or a couple of episodes ago that you can certainly hang the racist label on the homicide unit that prosecuted Adnan, that tried to put him in the frame. So they saw Jay as a vulnerable young Black man who has a history of drug dealing, so they can lean on him. And then here is this Muslim guy. The fact that he's a native-born American, the fact that his parents are naturalized American citizens, does not seem to really occur to them, nor does it seem to occur to them to actually look at Adnan himself and his record. They just kind of take this piece of, well, I'll use Rabia's words, hot garbage, and they bend it to their will, so to speak. And so this helps form the approach that the prosecution is going to take in the case. After all, you need to have some kind of motive, even if legally, states kind of vary with this, legally, you might not have to prove a motive. It certainly is helpful if you can tell the jury why you think this murderer murdered. So that's action number one. It undoubtedly, this second report from Mandy Johnson, undoubtedly helped shape the prosecution's case against Adnan. Now we get to a really controversial idea. Nobody disputes the Mandy Johnson, Tae-Soo Kim hoop-de-doo. Now I'm going to say that the second action that the Lees took was that they made the two anonymous phone calls. So the fact that the Lees, actually the Kims, Tae-Soo Kim, I'm sure with the full support of his sister, Hayes' mother, commissioned the Mandy Johnson original report, and that led to this other horrible piece of garbage that shaped. So that action of the Lees is completely indisputable, and its effect on the approach to the trial is also indisputable. But now we get to my second point, and this is much more controversial. I do not understand why it is, but it is. And that is the idea that the two anonymous phone calls, the first one on February 1st to Metro Crime Stoppers, and the second one on February 12th, 3 days after Hayes' body has been found, that went directly into the Baltimore City Homicide Unit and was taken by Daryl Massey, who is like a second-in-command, second-level detective on the case, who then produced his infamous memo, that those two phone calls came from Hayes' family. I will go to my dying day saying that Jay Wiles did not make those calls. I've said that before. I went into that in some detail when I was talking about Jay himself. But now I'm looking at these calls from the Lee's perspective. So I think it's pretty clear on February 1st, Jay Wiles would have had no clue, no reason, nothing to make that call. But the Lees definitely do. I talked about that earlier. Let's now look at the second call, which comes in on February 12th. If all that had been done was that first anonymous tip that went into Metro Crime Stoppers, I'm not sure that it would have had a whole lot of effect. Because remember, as I went into earlier, on February 1st, the police had already checked up on Don three times, but they do a fourth check, and that's when they get Catherine Michelle and they get those times that she reads to them. These are the hours that Don was working at another store on the day that this girl disappeared. They actually, though, go to Woodlawn in person. Why do they do that? Because they haven't done any checking up on Adnan as yet. He was just included in that original group of calls that was made on the afternoon, evening of January 13th by Scott Adcock. But there was no reason to have any suspicion about him, so they didn't follow up on him at all. But they really followed up on Don. I know I've said this before, I'm still beating that drum. It is a myth that Baltimore County did not try to break Don's alibi. They did. They were not successful because they did not realize what had actually been done with falsifying timesheets and with managers at two different stores being willing to say that Don had been working. Let's look at this February 12th call. So now the files are over at Baltimore City. And now there are missing posters out. We still don't have a reward being offered. I said last time, those reward posters were not printed until February 19th, and they were not delivered until February 24th. So there is no reward yet. I would postulate that February 12th is the date of this call, which was from Young Lee, and that is also the day that the Lees, with their community, especially this organization called the Korean American Safety Council, put together the reward. So I think the two events happened right at the same time. It makes sense. You're calling in a very specific tip now to the new police department because, as far as you can tell, the old police department didn't do squat, even though they did. And so the new ones, maybe you can juice them up a little bit. So you call them directly. For a long time, I was very puzzled. Why was the first call to Metro Crime Stoppers, but the second call was directly to the homicide unit? Well, I think the Lees just thought, well, calling MCS did nothing. So let's call and talk to the police directly, in person. So what is said in this call? And what is the immediate motive for it? So again, I keep going back to February 9th, that horrible, horrible day when they finally get that call that they've been expecting. We found Hayes' body. I don't know who had to go in and identify her, but it's pretty gruesome. Remember, she has been kind of partially exposed to the elements for 28 days. No dead body is a pretty sight, but this is pretty bad. I think I mentioned at one point that I've seen photographs of that crime scene, and I wish I had not seen them. So anyway, I'm sure the Lees thought, okay, in the midst of their utter grief, we were pretty sure that this was what had happened, that she was dead. We just could not imagine that we would hear nothing from her. Now we know the worst. Now the police will get on it. They'll get on the stick, surely. 3 days pass, and as far as they're concerned, nothing happens. They, I'm sure, expected an arrest, but nothing of the sort happens. So they decide, okay, let's call again, and we'll call Baltimore City Homicide and get the unit that's working on this case. That's how Daryl Massey gets this call. They get the direct line to that homicide unit. So he's there, middle of the afternoon, 3:15 to 3:30, and the phone rings. Normally, either Ritson or McGillivary would probably have taken the call, but they're not there. So he picks up the phone. What does he say? On February 12th, approximately 15:19 hours, so that's 3:19, your writer received a call from an anonymous caller. Now, here's the important part. Asian male, 18 to 21 years old, who advised investigators should concentrate on the victim's boyfriend. Of course, he's not her boyfriend. He's her ex-boyfriend. And then he misspells it. Remember, they've just gotten this case. Adna and Syed. And he's an Asian male, and he's 17, as a suspect in the murder. Okay, so right here, Massey tells us who made this call. It's a young Asian male, 18 to 21 years old. That's a little young for Young Lee. He's probably 16. But you have to remember here, Massey has to guess. This is a short phone call. He probably has a list of things you check off. I called it a checklist in the book. What is the age of the caller? What is the gender? What is the ethnicity? That kind of thing. So Young Lee has a very strong accent at the time. I've heard clips of him. I talked about that a little bit, that he was immersed in the Korean community in the way Hay was not. So he's kept his accent. Hay has largely shed hers. Okay, let's keep going here. The caller further advised that boyfriend has taken the victim to Leakin Park on past occasion for sexual encounter. Now, that's almost certainly not true. I think Adnan has been questioned about that. And he said, I believe, no, Hay and I never went to Leakin Park. There is a photograph of Hay and Adnan during the summer of 1998 at a park. I'm not sure who would have had access to that photograph here. But anyway, she's been found in Leakin Park. And I just don't know. Did they just make that up? I don't know. They've been pretty honest with the way they've done things, so I don't know. Now, here is, by the way, one of the things in this memo that has made people point a finger at Jay. Prior to concluding the phone interview, the caller further stated the victim broke off the relationship with her boyfriend about a week before she was reported missing. Well, of course, it wasn't a week. It was 3 weeks. Hay disappeared January 13th. She and Adnan had finally broken up over the weekend of December 19th through 20th. It's about 3.5 weeks. And Jay makes the same mistake in his intercept interview. He says they had been broken up for about a week. Much has been made of this. I just don't think it's dispositive of anything. So you got the time period wrong. I just don't think you can make a very big mountain out of that molehill. So then Massey says he tried to follow up with this call with star 57, which is caller ID. And the recording informed your writer the service was not available due to the caller not being in the service area. But that doesn't mean that the caller was calling from Outer Mongolia. It means he was calling from the kind of phone that could not be traced. One was a cell phone, which we are sure the Lees did not have. The other was a pay phone. And of course, remember, Yunhwa and Taesu both run Korean grocery stores that definitely had pay phones, somewhere in the back of the store probably. But that was one of many services that was offered by these little grocery stores. So that's at 3:19. So Massey jots down these things. And then 6 minutes after the start of the first call, he has a second call at 15:25, 3:25 p.m. Now, I'm going into this call in great detail. I know that may be trying your patience, but this is important. This call sets the tone for the whole approach to Adnan's case. So, the above anonymous person again called the homicide unit. This time, that caller About a year ago, the suspect informed a friend of his, and then in parentheses it says Basir Ali, who is also an Asian male, age 17. Basir, we know, is actually Yasser, who is a friend of Adnan's. If he ever hurt his girlfriend, he would drive her car into a lake. Baloney. The caller stated the suspect's friend attends Centennial High School in Columbia, Maryland, and his home phone number is, and then it gives a 410 area code phone number. Again, star 57 was activated. The recording stated the service was not available, blah, blah, blah. Okay, respectfully, Detective Daryl Massey. So the reasons for assuming that Jay must have made this call are what I already mentioned, that this guy, whoever he is, gets the time of the Hay and Adnan breakup wrong. And then we have this very weird thing about a specific name being included in this memo, a known friend of Adnan, and that it even includes his phone number. And we know it's the correct phone number because the police are going to follow up on it by calling Yasser and interviewing him. And he says, no, I don't know a thing about it. I don't know what you're talking about. Poor guy. He must have thought, how did I get myself into this? But let's look at this in a little more detail. Now, in my book, I went into a huge rabbit trail here and maybe a rabbit hole also. I'm not going to do that here because I think the explanation for how this caller, if it was Young Lee, could possibly know Yasser Ali is pretty simple. Let me just say, by the way, that Jay apparently maybe knew Yasser because we know he went to a party that Yasser attended. This may actually have been Krista Meyer's birthday party. I don't know for sure. Yasser wasn't really a friend of Krista's, but he was a good friend of Adnan's, and Adnan may have said, can my friend Yasser come too? I don't know. But so you can kind of make a case for Jay knowing Yasser, but how could Young Lee know Yasser? Many a theory has foundered on this one rock. How could Young Lee have made this phone call if he got the breakup time wrong, which I think is perfectly understandable. I don't think that needs much in the way of explanation. But then he knows this friend of Adnan's whom he could not possibly have known, but he could have known him very easily. And for this little bit of the story, we go to the trial transcript. I'm not going to read you the trial transcript. I have it in the book. Trial transcripts are very, very choppy. So let me just summarize. Young Lee is asked to testify at trial. Other members of his family, certainly the grandparents, do not testify. His mother cannot speak English. She could have testified through an interpreter. And I don't think anybody thought too much about questioning Tae-Soo Kim, Hay's uncle. But Young Lee gives extensive testimony. And remember, he's only a teenager. He's just lost his sister. I think he held up pretty well on the stand. So he's asked about the afternoon that Hay disappeared. And if you remember, Young Lee did the first round of calls. They went up, they got Hay's diary and her address book. He went through it, and he picked out names and phone numbers of probably of people he had heard Hay mention, and he called them. Adnan, of course, got a call from Young Lee. He testified to that. And nobody knew a thing. And that's when they called the police. So on the stand, Young Lee is asked about his call to Adnan on the afternoon of January 13th. And he's asked, well, how did you end up talking to Adnan and what did he say? And Young Lee says, well, I called this number that was in Hay's diary. It was on the same page as Don's name. Now, this is the infamous page where Hay has scribbled Don's name 127 times. She puts that 127 Don's exclamation point in a circle. This is right at the very end of her diary. We think that she was sitting there doodling Don's name over and over again. If you've never been a teenage girl, that activity seems completely nuts to you. If you've ever been a teenage girl, you're probably nodding your head about now. All right, so anyway, she's writing Don's name as they are engaged in this marathon 3+ hours phone call. Remember, she calls Don, she pages him, he calls her when she gets home from his house that evening, and they stay on the phone till 3 a.m. into the wee hours of January 13th. And then at the top of that page, there is a phone number. So I think young Lee is perfectly justified in thinking, well, this must be Don's phone number. So he calls it, and he said, when the caller answered, I realized it was Adnan. And so he's asked, well, how did you know it was Adnan? I recognized his voice. Now, he does say in other testimony that sometimes Adnan would call the house and he would pick up the phone. Usually, Adnan and Hay had a system worked out where the phone would not actually ring. They would use the call waiting feature and, you know, they had a whole little procedure worked out, which I won't go into here. But he had talked to Adnan on the phone some just at his house. But he says, okay, I recognized his voice. So then he's asked, well, how did you know him? And he gives a very specific answer. He says, I had met him at my mother's store or my mother's old store. So he varies it just a little bit because remember, he ends up having to give two sets of testimony because there are two trials because of the first trial being a mistrial. So he had already been on the stand once when that mistrial was declared, and then he had to come back and do it all over again. So he talks about meeting Adnan at his mother's store and at the mall. What does that mean? Well, if you think about it, it's really pretty simple. So he says, my mother's old store. I don't know where her new store was. That implies that she had decided that she could do better at another location. Yun Hua, for all her weeping at trial and all that sort of thing, she comes across as just this very emotionally fragile person. But actually, she was quite the businesswoman, I have to say. So she had this other store, and Young Lee says, I met Adnan there. And of course, you have to remember something that I think gets overlooked a lot. Hay and Adnan had been friends since 9th grade. Hay had started the magnet program at the same time that Adnan had, and those magnet kids were a pretty tight bunch. So it would not have been out of the way at all at some point for Adnan to have visited Hay's mom's store, either because he was just curious or he was in the neighborhood or something, who knows. And there was this kid, this younger Korean kid. And he says, oh, you must be Young Lee, Hay's brother. And Young Lee says, yeah, what's it to you? So anyway, we know it's been testified to a number of times that Adnan has a gift. He has a knack for connecting with people, for making friends. I think this is a bit of a side issue, but I've just found it so striking. When he is interviewed by Sarah Koenig on Serial, and I think she asks him, I will be honest, I have not gone back and looked this up. This is what I remember, which I, as I say, to me was very striking. She asks him something like, did people pick on you in the jail because you were pretty young? And after all, you were accused of murdering your girlfriend. Did that cause problems for you? And he says, no, nobody ever really hassled me. And then if you remember, oh, this is one of my most vivid memories of Sarah Koenig's talks with Adnan. He formed this little breakfast club and he would make special food, getting items he could get from the commissary. I'm not quite sure how this all worked. And then he'd make special breakfast food for the people in his group. I kind of had the idea that being in Adnan's breakfast group was kind of a coup, you were looked upon as sort of special if you were in that. And one of these days, I'm going to make that apple and cheddar omelet, I believe it is, that he says he made. That was one of the favorite things that he would make for his group. So, back to the scene in the store. It is not at all out of the way to imagine a situation where Adnan says, you know, if you ever want to get together with us guys and go to a movie or something, let me know. We like to do that sort of thing on Friday or Saturday nights at the mall. And Rabia talks in her book about the aunties would be out in force on weekend nights reporting on if kids were going to the movies. I think that was something that they weren't really supposed to be doing. So young Lee may perfectly well have met Yasser in one of these outings. He just says at the mall. He doesn't make any statement about how many times he did this. And that phone number of Yasser's could be something that he had jotted down somewhere. Remember, I think it's a cell phone number. I'm not quite sure. But remember, Adnan's mother really keeps a pretty tight leash on him, although he sure managed to get in a lot of stuff under her nose, I must say. But maybe he said, it would be better if you called Yasser to find out what movie we're going to. I don't know. But it makes as much sense for young Lee to have Yasser Ali's phone number that it does for Jay. Jay wasn't going around going to the movies with those boys. He is in a totally different social group. So somewhere, young Lee has Yasser Ali's phone number scribbled down. And then he says, oh, let me think. We were joking around once, and Adnan said if he ever hurt his girlfriend, he'd drive her car into a lake, which doesn't have any relevance to Hay at all. Hay didn't even have her car until that previous fall. They hadn't even started dating till April because he said about a year ago. Well, on February 12th, a year ago is February 12th of 1998. Hay and Adnan weren't even dating then. So what happened here? There are two calls, one at 3:19, one at 3:25. My theory, for what it's worth, and I think it makes a lot of sense, of course, since it's my theory, is that this call, or rather these two calls, were made from the payphone in the back of Yunhua's store. And you can imagine young Lee on the phone. He's nervous. He's never called the police before. And his uncle and his mom are standing there kind of coaching him. They've gone over what he's supposed to say. And so he gets Daryl Massey and he says his piece at 3:19 about just saying, well, you should look at the boyfriend, Adnan Syed, and Leakin Park is a place where he and Hay used to go. And then he hangs up the phone after he says, you know, they broke up, Hay broke up with him, and now she's missing. And I can imagine the uncle and the mom saying, you didn't say the most important thing. You didn't say that thing about if he ever hurt his girlfriend, because that shows that he's thinking about hurting his girlfriend. You've got to call him back. Oh, mom, do I have to? Yes, you do. So at 3:25, the second call comes through. It's perfectly understandable. It's a scenario that makes a lot of sense. It explains why there are two separate calls. Okay, now, another question that has been raised about Massey and the veracity of this memo is that Massey refused to show up at trial and testify about it. There's always been this lurking suspicion in the Adnan is innocent camp that Daryl Massey somehow just fabricated this memo, which, if you think it through logically and you put it in the proper place in the timeline, that just makes no sense. Why would he do that? At this point, they've just been given the case, and he's already coming up with this elaborate conspiracy theory? No way. But Christina Gutierrez, who has flashes of legal acumen, has subpoenaed him to appear to talk about that call. She's interested in that call, and well, she should be, because that February 12th call is just pivotal. I think it is not an exaggeration to say that. Without the February 12th call, I'm not sure that this case goes the way it does, with the police single-mindedly pursuing Adnan. But boy, they've got a lead now. Baltimore County has handed them a whole boatload of nothing, and now they have something, so they are hound dogs on the trail. So Christina Gutierrez wants to know a little more about this, and Massey evaded her subpoena. And if you know anything about how subpoenas work, they have to be served in person. And if you can evade the process server, then you don't have to obey the subpoena. You'll remember that when I talked about Deborah Renner, she had gotten a summons in the mail. That's different. But a subpoena is served in person. And if you fail to do what it says to do after you've been served, you can be held in contempt and you can be in real legal peril. So Christina Gutierrez is outraged that Massey did not show up. He managed to be absent, out of the area, visiting relatives, blah, 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 and that subpoena was never served on him. So, of course, people say, well, Massey doesn't want to testify because he made that memo up. No, that is not what that means at all. Massey doesn't want to testify because he did not make the memo up. And remember, by the time of Adnan's trial, the whole case hinges on Jay. And I'm not sure that it's ever said outright that Jay made this anonymous call, but that certainly is the implication, that Jay is the guy in the know. And they do not want Massey to get up there and testify, well, no, it wasn't this guy who's sitting here, this Jay Wiles. It was somebody else entirely. If Christina Gutierrez had been on her game that particular day, which might have been true, she could have had Jay stand up and read the section from Massey's memo in which Massey is quoting the caller. And then she could have said to Massey, does he sound like your caller? And of course, Massey's under oath. And I think he would have drawn the line at lying and he would have said, no, that's not who called me. Well, who did? That would have raised a host of questions at trial that nobody wants Massey answering. So they say, you stay out of the way. We do not want you testifying about that call. But guess what? For the HBO documentary, whereas Ritz and McGillivray do not show up, and they showed up plenty at trial, Massey does, and he is quite loquacious, and he is quite clear that this was a Korean young male. It is not Jay. Period. End of discussion. Now let's talk about one final aspect of this whole Lee family involvement in the case, and that is the matter of the reward that was eventually offered and publicized by February 26th, when the posters are actually delivered. And you can see pictures of these posters offering the reward. I have at least one image of it in my appendix in my book. So this is money that's put together by Metro Crime Stoppers itself. It has some discretionary funds. $575 is what they put up. And then the Korean American Safety Council puts up $2,500. So $3,075. A nice little chunk of change, especially back in 1999. So, who got that reward? Well, the caller, remember, way back in the mists of time, February 1st, that call to MCS, the leaker says that reward to that caller was paid out on November 1st. And I talked about this quite a bit in my episode on Jay, that Jay almost certainly got that reward, that the police would have had access to that four-digit ID number, and they used that as a further nudge to get Jay to go ahead and testify against Adnan at trial. But of course, here I'm talking about the Lee family, and so the question would be, well, why didn't they just claim that reward? After all, they called in the tip, and that money is from their own community. They're not interested in enriching themselves, of course, but their attitude might have been, well, we can get the money back plus this extra from Metro Crime Stoppers. After all, we made the tip that got this guy arrested. His court date is set, and now he's going to be tried in another month or so. So we are due this reward, and we'll just put it back in the fund. And then the next time somebody commits a violent crime against us, we'll have that money available. But they don't do that. They would have claimed it much earlier if they had been wanting to do that. So why don't they claim it? Why do they let it just sit there? I'll tell you why. Because to them, Jay is a hero. I had never realized that before until I was thinking this through for about the 5,000th time. Jay is their boy. He's the one who put Adnan away. Without Jay, as I've said repeatedly, and other people have said repeatedly, there is no case. So as far as they are concerned, he deserves that reward. Whether or not he was actually the tipster, they don't necessarily know about all this backing and forthing behind the scenes. And I don't know if they ever really knew for sure that the reward had been paid out. But they're perfectly happy for Jay to have it. Now, Adnan goes to prison. He's found guilty at the end of his second trial. Jay stands up there, of course, and lies his head off. At one point, Adnan says to Jay, "You're pathetic." And boy, was he right. And as far as Adnan is concerned, Jay has done this for the money. But he doesn't really know all the other stuff that's been going on. But that does not reduce the fact that Jay is pathetic. And Adnan goes to prison and the Lees grieve, but they are pleased at least that Hayes' murderer has gotten justice as they see it. And remember, they are perfectly sincere in this. They are not underhanded. They are not nefarious. They are not lying. They think that justice has been done. And then in 2014, Serial hits them like a bombshell. And all of a sudden, this enormously painful event from 15 years ago is now being talked about all over the world. And we know from a Reddit post that he did listen to at least some of Serial. He thinks it's disgusting. He thinks all of these people who are saying, "Ooh, why don't we have a meetup and talk about the case?" He says, "You guys are sickening." And of course, in a way, he's right. People are looking upon this case as a fascinating murder mystery, not as a personal tragedy. And then things don't really die down, but at least Serial ends. But then Undisclosed comes along, and here are these three brilliant lawyers. And they're not trying to do what Sarah Koenig did. Sarah Koenig just wanted to tell a balanced, unbiased story, but that's not what Rabia Chaudhry, Colin Miller, and Susan Simpson want to do. They want to prove that Adnan is innocent. And then Bob Ruff comes along and he tries to do the same thing on his then-titled Serial Dynasty podcast. And then people just start talking about this case constantly. It's all over the place. It's in books, it's in podcasts, it's on YouTube videos, and the Lees must have felt like the wound is being ripped open every single day. And then, to top it all off, Adnan is released from prison in September of 2022. Talk about the wound being reopened. There's a whole new wound opened. This man who murdered our beloved family member is walking free. He is a murderer. Why have they done this? And they start immediately pushing back. And of course, if you've followed this case at all, you know that Maryland did not follow proper procedure on giving them a chance to appear in person. And so therefore, that gives them a wedge. And finally, after years of wrangling, 2.5 years of wrangling, we have this final hearing, which took place this past March, in which Ivan Bates and the judge split the baby. Yes, Adnan is a murderer. No, he doesn't have to go back to prison. And that's what the Lees are stuck with. So I'm going to leave it there. I don't know what, if anything, they plan to do in the future. But I hope I have proven to you that on the one hand, the Lees were honorable and they acted within their legal rights. And on the other hand, they played a huge part in getting an innocent man sent to prison for murder. Come back next week and we will continue to explore this fascinating case further.